the last lesson in the book of Genesis, and that starting in Genesis chapter 49. Here we go, Genesis part 53, here, starting in chapter 49, verse 29. This, of course, being right after Jacob had pronounced all the blessings on his sons, and he gives the final instruction, which, of course, is for his burial. Jacob, of course, has been very preoccupied throughout his life with his death, and he's coming very quickly upon the time of his death. And so he gives instructions to his sons and start in verse 29, and he charged them and said unto them, I am to be gathered unto my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for possession of a burying place. So if you remember, Abraham, of course, did buy that field from Ephron the Hittite, and he was buried there with Sarah, also Isaac with Rebekah, and as we find out in the next verse, Leah is the one who is buried there in the cave, the wife of Jacob. Because, of course, Rachel had died prematurely on the way to Bethlehem. That, of course, chapter 35, verses 16 through 20. We don't really need to revisit those verses. But just the logistics of getting a body from one place to the next at that time, since there was no helicopters or hearses, the body would have been rather pungent by the time you moved it from one place to the other. So she was buried just on the way where she died, and there was a grave marker, or a pillar, as the Bible says, placed at the birthplace of Rachel, or at the burying place of Rachel. And so the other sister, Leah, who Jacob was married to but never really cared for near as much as Rachel, is the one who ended up being buried. And it's what that shows is that God honored Rachel, her being the one buried at the in the family gravesite there, even though Jacob never loved Leah as much. God, in fact, did honor Leah. And so if you look at verse 31, and they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife, there they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, Jacob says, and there I buried Leah. The purchase of the field and of the cave that is therein was from the children of Heth. So there's the last instruction and the last words, as recorded by Moses, that Jacob uttered. And having then taken care of all the worldly business that Jacob could possibly think of to have been taken care of, and when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people. So he died. So that's the end of Jacob, and he lived a good, long, and difficult life, as interesting, but a difficult life. So at this point in the chapter, it's an interesting thing, the way the chapter 50 is written. We only get the reaction of Joseph, not the reaction of the other sons of Jacob. Joseph, of course, was probably much closer to his father than the other boys, and but you know, of course, all the writers of the Bible being inspired by the Holy Spirit, Moses being no exception, is inspired to record the reaction of Joseph at this point. So we don't really know the reaction of the other boys, but So it's hard to tell, you know, whether there was great grieving in their minds, or, you know, great wailing and gnashing of teeth when Jacob died, or whether they were relieved, or whether there was no crying on their behalf, or what the whole situation was. We'll never know. But for Joseph's part, in Genesis 50, verse 1, "And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him." So obviously there was a great sense of loss on behalf of Joseph. And again, because of the length of the journey, they were probably 300 miles away from the burial cave that Jacob had requested to be buried in. And you know, even in the wintertime, you don't want to transport a body that kind of distance and have it rotten away. take the chance of having it rotting away. At one time, of course, this is a lost art and something that modern science is not able to do, but you all realize that at one time, the Egyptians were able to embalm bodies. You know, the mummies, as you know, that had been found, were all embalmed and preserved for thousands of years, so we have an account of that here in the Bible, that they embalmed the body of Jacob, and that on the request of Joseph. Here in verse 2, "And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. And the physicians embalmed Israel." And it's astounding. You know, we've seen time and time and time again over the years, throughout various different accounts on various different subjects, how scientifically accurate the Bible is. And here's just one more instance of the Bible being extremely accurate in its account on this particular subject, one that modern-day science has no authority on. But the verse says, verse 3, that 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. So the mourning went on for 70 days. Well, what's the connection and what's the significance of that? Well, here the Bible accurately records that there's 40 days needed for the actual embalming process. But the Egyptians mourned for Jacob and in his death. That, of course, because of Joseph. He was the father of Joseph, and Joseph being greatly beloved of the Egyptians. They mourned for Jacob for 70 days. And so you say to yourself, what's the connection between the 40 days and the 70 days? Well, if you go to secular history, here there's a book. It's written by George Bush, and that was not the president, by the way, but it's a man named George Bush, and it's a book called Notes on Genesis, written in 1979. Here on page 419, and I'll quote, "The process of embalming among the ancient Egyptians is thus described by Herodotus." Herodotus, of course, being an ancient historian, and I quote Herodotus, he writes about this embalming process, "The body was given to the embalmers, who first took out the brains and entrails and washed them in palm wine impregnated with strong astringent drugs, after which they began to anoint the body with the oil of cedar, myrrh, cinnamon, and cassia, and this lasted 30 days. They next put it in a solution of nitrate, which is saltpeter, for 40 days longer. So they allowed 70 days to complete the embalming, after which they bound it up in swathes of linen besmeared with gum. Being then able to resist putrefaction, it was delivered to the relatives, enclosed in a wooden or paper case somewhat resembling a coffin, and laid in the catacomb, a grave belonging to the family, where it was placed in an upright posture against the wall. But if you notice the time, the actual embalming process was 40 days. But the process of purifying or cleaning out of the body, you know, of course, removing the brains, the entrails, and then the cleaning out of the inside, took 30 days. And so it was a total of 70 days. Well, just as the Bible explains, there was 40 days for the embalming, but the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days, which is the fulfilling of the 70 days of between the 30 days of cleaning and the 40 days of embalming. So once again, the Bible is extremely accurate, even on the scientific front, and agrees with the secular history written by Herodotus. So time and time again that happens. Gemma, go ahead.
I got a question that's probably off the wall, but it should maybe it's in that book. In that book, maybe somewhere in that book, he tells us how the Egyptians made those big pyramids.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be nice to know.
That would be nice to know, but it does not. No. It does not.
Otherwise, they made big rocks around and made them flat.
Otherwise, we'd have that mystery solved. As a matter of fact, one of the things, Cassia, is unknown. They don't know what that is. And so that's the unknown ingredient that they have not been able to figure out what that refers to for the embalming process. So, like I say, you can reproduce the embalming process, but they have not been able to actually do the embalming as the Egyptians obviously were. I mean, it's not just a myth, because here we have these mummified bodies that were preserved perfectly. So, and the Bible speaks of that, and obviously it was true. So, but no, there is no mention of how they got those 70-ton rocks up to the very top of the pyramid. Otherwise, we'd know that for sure. But after the embalming process is all said and done, here Joseph asks Pharaoh, indirectly, for permission to leave to bury his father. You read that in verses 4 and 5. And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, lo, I die in my grave which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there shalt thou bury me. Now therefore let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. So this is one of the unknown, I guess, mysteries, I suppose, of this chapter, is why Joseph didn't go directly to Pharaoh and ask him himself. One can come up with a number of different reasons why there's possibilities, but probably one of the best probabilities of why Joseph didn't go to Pharaoh himself would be that the times of mourning for a Hebrew are accompanied by a lack of shaving and a lack of haircutting. In other words, the hair is grown and the beard is let grown and all that. And for an Egyptian, you know, just like you saw with the movie The Ten Commandments, old Yul Brynner had a shaved head and it was clean shaven and no beard or anything. And that was offensive to an Egyptian to have facial hair and the long hair and all that. And so rather than offend Pharaoh, he went to the house of Pharaoh and asked them to pass on the request. So that was probably what was done, and for that reason. And whatever the reason that Joseph did not go directly to Pharaoh, because, you know, the relationship was obviously a good relationship. And for whatever the reason, permission was granted. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury thy father according as he has made thee swear. So permission is granted, and Joseph promises, you know, if you let me go up, I will come back after we're done. So that in verse 50, I will come again. So I'll come back again. So the provisions are made, and really, the procession, of course, this is a 300-mile-long journey, and this is a procession then that would have astounded anyone, even if you were remember the procession that when JFK died, or when any president died, or when any head of state has ever died, and you've seen the procession, the funeral procession, this probably would have beat them all. Because if you read the description, you have a funeral procession of tremendous size, and it was a 300-mile-long funeral procession. Of course, you know, JFK, his body was transported all the way across the country. Abraham Lincoln, his body went by train across the country. But meanwhile, here we read in verses 7 through 9, and Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh. See, first of all, just imagine how many servants there would have been in the Pharaoh's house, in Pharaoh the grand poobah of all of Egypt. There would have been a tremendous number of servants. Also, the elders of his house and all the elders of the land of Egypt. So that would have probably been a tremendous number of people as far as the Egyptians go. And all of the house of Joseph and his brethren and his father's house, only their little ones and their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. So the only ones that stayed behind were the small ones and the animals. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. Besides that, and those would have been Egyptians also, and I suppose they would have been along for security reasons. So chariots and horsemen accompanied this huge procession, and it was a very great company, not just a great company or a large company, but a very great company that went. So it would have been a tremendous sight to see, I'm certain, even by today's standards. So, quite a few more Egyptians, I'm certain, than Hebrews were involved in this procession. And before entering into the land of Canaan, the whole procession stops, and that for 7 days of mourning. I wrote mourning wrong. For those of you who have an outline, it's not for perpetual mourning where the sun rises, but for mourning for the dead. There's so many Egyptians present, by the way, that the Canaanites, they're right there on the Jordan River, and the Canaanites that live in the land across the Jordan can see them. And of course, there's all kinds of wailing and lamentations going on, and gnashing of teeth and all that. And there's so many Egyptians there that the Canaanites assume that it's an Egyptian funeral, that the Egyptians are mourning for someone, as we read in the next couple of verses. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians." Wherefore, the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. So the Canaanites just assumed that it was the Egyptians that had lost someone, because of all this wailing and gnashing of teeth that was going on by, of course, the Egyptians. And there were so many of them as compared to the number of the Hebrews. So Egyptians, after the 7 days, the Egyptians, for good reason, do not enter into the land of Canaan. Probably because it probably would have freaked out the Canaanites. They probably would have thought they were being invaded. There were so many Egyptians present, along with the horsemen and the chariots and all that. So, more than likely, they were probably fairly close to the burial site, and so the Egyptians stayed put while the boys and Joseph went on to bury their father. verses 12 through 14, and his sons did unto him according as he commanded them, for his sons carried him into the land of Canaan. Now it's quite humorous, I think, that most of the commentaries that you read, I've read quite a few over the years about Genesis, and most of the commentaries that you read will have the threshing floor of Atad in the land of Canaan. Even though the threshing floor is said to be beyond the Jordan, and you have his sons carrying him into the land of Canaan, they still place the threshing floor in the land of Canaan. Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But meanwhile, so they bury him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, which Abraham brought with the field for possession of the burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. And Joseph returned into Egypt, he and his brethren and all that went up with him to bury his father after he had buried his father. So you see that everybody returned. Now you kind of think about that. You think, well, they had all left Egypt, and why did they return? Especially knowing the prophecy that was given to Abraham about the captivity of the Hebrews in Egypt. Remember in chapter 15, verse 13, God says unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Well, and yet all the brothers and all the company returns back to Egypt with Joseph. And you think to yourself, why in the world, I mean, having left Egypt and knowing about this prophecy, why in the world would you return to Egypt, knowing that there's every probability, or good possibility anyway, that Egypt is the land where your seed is going to be afflicted and be, servants and prisoners for 400 years? You think about that, and the first thing that pops into my mind, of course, is unbelief. Unbelief. Because certainly they must have known about this prophecy. I mean, these things are handed down from generation to generation, and Moses certainly knew about it. And that was years and years and years and years later, hundreds of years later. So unbelief probably played a great part in their returning. Carol said they would have been considered escaping. Well, Joseph probably, being one of the ahead in the land of Egypt, a dignitary in the land of Egypt, of course, almost considered Pharaoh, he was under obligation to return. But the brothers, were they really under obligation to return? Not really. Although you could make the argument, I suppose, that this great company of Egyptians, plus all the security, with the horsemen and the chariots, that they were sent to keep an eye on the Hebrews to make sure that they came back. That all the Hebrews left except for the children, as sort of a surety that they would come back. There's lots of arguments to be made of why they came back, but it makes you wonder. Here's a perfect time to to escape. And if you knew the prophecy, and especially if you believed the prophecy, why wouldn't you have, before you left Egypt to begin with, picked up your belongings, and especially your children, and taken them with you, and just thought to yourself, I'm not going to come back, because I'm not going to be, you know, I believe the prophecy, and I'm not going to be one to be in servitude. My seed is not going to be in servitude for the next 400 years. So, unbelief is probably what it came down to. They probably thought, well, it's not me, or it's not going to be my seed, or this is here in the land of Egypt, this is not the land that's going to happen, because here we have it so much easier. You know, this is a land where we're appreciated. This is a land where we have life very easy. And certainly that couldn't happen to us here. Sort of like us today here in these United States, we have life very easy, don't we, Mike? And we all think to ourselves, well, that could never happen to us here, you know. So, and that was really the case, wasn't it? We read in Deuteronomy, in Egypt is a land that was very easy to grow things. Canaan, you had to depend on God to send the rain because there was no water. So, well, anyway, all comes down to faith, I suppose. Well, everybody gets back to Egypt safely. And then we have to deal with sort of a different part of the chapter. Moses takes a turn of the pen, as it were, and we have the guilt of Joseph's brothers. As it turns out, they still have guilty feelings about what they had done to Joseph years and years ago when they had sold him to the slave traders, and he'd been sold into slavery in the land of Egypt. So in verse 15 we read, and when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us, and will certainly requite us all the evil which we did unto him. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, thy father did command before he died, saying, so shall ye say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil. And now, we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spake unto him. As Carol said, yes, they were eaten up with guilt. You're exactly right. Well, his brothers were really fearing that Joseph had not forgiven him. He said he'd forgiven them, but they were very much fearing that he really had not forgiven them, and that he was just saying that because their father was alive. But it really points out some lessons about forgiveness. If you look in your Bibles at Matthew chapter 18, verses 23 through 35, forgiven of something is quite different than forgiving others or forgiving oneself for what you have done. Joseph had forgiven the brothers, but they had obviously not forgiven themselves, or had not received or believed the forgiveness that Joseph had given to them. Here in Matthew chapter 18, we read in this parable, "Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king, which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. But forasmuch as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children, and all that he had in payment to be made. The servant therefore fell down and worshipped him, saying, Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. Then the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion, and loosed him, and forgave him the debt. But the same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants, which owed him 100 pence. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, Pay me that thou owest. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. And he would not, but went and cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what was done, they were very sorry and came and told unto their Lord all that was done. Then his Lord, after that he had called him, said unto him, O thou wicked servant, I forgave thee all that debt because thou desirest me. Shouldest not thou also have had compassion on thy fellow servant, even as I had pity on thee? And his Lord was wroth and delivered him unto the tormentors till he should pay all that was due unto him. So likewise shall my heavenly Father do also unto you, if ye from your hearts forgive not every one his brother their trespasses." See, if we're able to forgive others truly, then we believe in forgiveness. Let me say that one more time for those of you who didn't hear it. If we're able to forgive other people the things that they've done to us, then we truly believe in forgiveness. And if we believe in forgiveness, we can also accept the forgiveness of other people. You know, a liar can never trust another person's promises. You ever heard that saying? A liar can never trust another person's promises, because he knows that he's a liar, and he never trusts something that comes out of another person's mouth. So our human nature can never forgive sin, but it's only when sin is forgiven will the forgiveness of God become a model for our relationships with one another. As Paul says in Colossians 3:13, "Forbearing one another and forgiving one another, if any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye." So Moses never mentions that the brothers' sin against Jacob was ever revealed to Jacob. That was a skeleton that was kept in the closet, and Jacob never knew anything about it. Jacob never mentions it during his last words to the brethren. He never says anything about it as he's giving out the blessings or anything of that nature. So, what you're reading here, this message that was sent to Joseph about thy father did command before he died, saying, So shall ye say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin. All that was probably a lie, and it was a made-up lie about the testament of a dead man. Boy, that's a big sin, isn't it? And Joseph knew it. And that's probably why he started to cry. Joseph wept when they spake unto him. Because Joseph knew they were lying. He loved his brothers, but his brothers feared him. And they had not accepted his forgiveness. They feared him, and the fact of the matter is that the Bible teaches that love and fear are incompatible one with another. 1 John 4:18 says there is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. So they had not accepted the forgiveness of Joseph, and they had not forgiven themselves for what they had done. Verse 18, and his brethren also went down and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we be thy servants. Well, so they offered to be the slaves of Joseph. And what Joseph says to them reveals really one of the great mysteries of how God works in this wonderful world and universe of ours. You've all heard at one time or another somebody ask that question, where was God when? You know, when this disaster happened, or that natural disaster occurred, when these people died, or when a child suffers or dies, or where was God when? I can't tell you how many times I've heard that question. Where was God when? How could God let that happen? A loving God would never. The statement always starts out in a way like that. But Joseph's answer truly reveals one of the mysteries of God. Verse 19, Joseph said unto them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? Well, first of all, Joseph wasn't God, was he? He was sent to Egypt to be God's representative. As Pharaoh had said, when he chose Joseph to do the job of collecting up the food and storing crude for 7 years to bring the world through 7 years of famine, Pharaoh said unto his servants in Genesis 41:38, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh was right. Joseph was sent to be the representative of God. And Joseph wasn't there to judge his brothers in their sin either. Just as we're not here to judge our brothers in their sin. Because who is the judge of sin? It's the Lord. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 30 says, for we know him that hath said, vengeance belongeth unto me, I will recompense, saith the Lord, and again the Lord shall judge his people. And Joseph, more than anyone else, more than anyone else that I can think of, other than the Lord himself, truly could see God working through evil in the world. could see God working through his life, but doing it in a way that worked, that used evil for good, that used evil to work out God's purpose in that through the life of Joseph. Joseph says in verse 20, "But as for you, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass as it is this day, to save much people alive." Wow. I'll bet the brothers just about hit the floor when they heard that. That the evil that they had done unto Joseph, God had used and meant to use it in order to save hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, by the actions that they had taken that very day when they sold Jacob to those traitors and he was then taken to Egypt to be a servant.
Yeah, he separated them. He stayed with them and he never accomplished God's purpose.
Exactly right. So it's always important to remember who's in control. That question, where was God when? How could God let this happen? You know, those questions like that should never roll off a believer's lips, especially one who understands that God will always prevail and his purpose will prevail in the midst of a world full of evil. As Paul says in Romans 8:28, one of my very favorite verses, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose." It's the same thing that the Lord said in his, as far as I know, the shortest parable in the Bible. Because we know that every mention of leaven in the Bible is always a reference to evil. Is always a reference to evil. And we have in Matthew chapter 13, verse 33, a one-verse parable. And the parable is to show God's use of evil. And not only the use of evil, but the use of ever-increasing evil in the world. Ever-increasing evil in the world to further his kingdom. So when you look around and say, it just seems like things are getting worse and worse and worse all the time, where is God? The answer is in the shortest parable that I know of in the Bible, Matthew 13, 33. "Another parable spoke he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal, till the whole was leavened." Till all the kingdom was filled with evil. But that doesn't mean that God's purpose won't be worked out through, even in the midst of evil. God will use evil to do his purpose. The brothers' use of evil against Joseph perfected him. Remember this, it perfected him to perform that which God intended him to do. Don't let that pass you by. Don't miss that point. That the things that Joseph experienced in his life, whether working in Potiphar's house, whether being in jail, or whether being put in charge of all of Egypt, all those things led to Joseph fulfilling the purpose which God ultimately intended him to do. which was to save the world from that which was going to happen. Remember what the author of Hebrews says about the Lord. In Hebrews 2:10, "For it became Him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." So when we read about the sufferings of Joseph because of the evil that was brought against him, all those sufferings because of that evil only worked to make him perfect for the job that God intended him to ultimately do. So understanding God's workings and purpose in his life, which he did. Remember, Joseph had the dreams that showed him that they would all be bowing down to him. Joseph and his forgiveness toward his brothers, that forgiveness was perfect and complete. We read in Genesis 50:21, "Now therefore fear ye not. I will nourish you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. So now we come to Joseph's last days. When Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children and children of the third generation, so that would be his great-grandchildren. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were brought up upon Joseph's knee. Notice Ephraim, the younger son, is mentioned first. And that was, of course, Jacob's prophecy that that Ephraim would be preeminent over Manasseh, that the younger son would be preeminent over the older, and he is mentioned first. And Joseph has faith then that God will bring the Hebrews out of Canaan out of Egypt into the land of Canaan. That, of course, being the promise that God made to Abraham. Verses 24, "Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And then he makes the promise that his bones will leave with the Exodus. Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and he shall carry up my bones from hence." That you find, of course, in Exodus chapter 13, where when Moses is bringing them out, they also bring out those bones, which are Joseph's, which had been, the body had been embalmed for 359 years, which was the only thing that the children of Israel had for the remembrance of the promise that God had made. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straightly sworn the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you." So that promise was absolutely kept. And then, of course, in Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, the bones are delivered into the gravesite in the land of Canaan. So the embalmed body of Joseph remained in Egypt, but was unburied as a remembrance for the Hebrews for a time. You think, well, 359 years, but you think back, what's the year, Mike? 2014. And you think, how long ago is 359 years from now? Well, Columbus was discovering North America at that time. I mean, you know, that's how long ago it was. That's how long those bones laid around as a remembrance of God's promise before God visited them. And so that was the only thing that they had to remind them that God would in fact visit and bring them out of captivity. So Joseph died, verse 26, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So, not to stay in Egypt forever, but rather to then be taken along with the exodus of all the Hebrews and leave, as God had promised, to be taken into the promised land of Canaan.